Hello and welcome to An Awful Lot of Running, a Doctor Who podcast.
Woo!
A Doctor Who podcast.
A Doctor Who podcast.
No, don't do that. No.
Hello, dear listeners. Sorry about that little opening. I don't know what's got into them this episode. I'm just trying to get this thing edited and they're just singing away. Do you guys hear that too? Why is there knocking? Give me 2 seconds. What? Did you do this to Jack? And Robin? What did you do to Jack? Did you do this to Jack?
Think of him as my prelude, and now his song is sung.
You can't just delete his files. Who are you?
My notation is maestro.
Okay, cool. But what are you?
I am music.
Oh well, you're on the wrong thing here. This is a podcast. I mean, there's music in it, but it's a podcast.
And you're a genius.
Yeah, I suppose. Yes, I am quite smart. Thank you. Yeah.
You're the greatest composer who ever lived.
I wouldn't say composer. Again, this is for a podcast. I'm an editor. It's a very, very different thing. What a good composer. Jed's a good composer, but I'm just an editor. Yeah.
Clever enough to find the lost chord.
Lost Court. Oh, did that? Oh no. Is that because of those two? Did they hit the right note and they found a chord or whatever? Oh God.
But it's so sad.
Yeah, it is kind of sad actually. Really, the music's meant to be more, my thing. I should be doing the singing.
You never had the luck.
You can say that again. They never let me sing on these things. I mean, I never let me sing on these things. I don't like singing. Well, I do like singing. I like singing a lot, but
You never got that break.
well, yeah, no, not yet. I mean, I'm working on it. I think.
All those melodies stifled and strangled inside you.
Again, not melody. I mean, I do like music. I have many playlists and don't get me wrong, I do love music, but I would currently say it's probably podcasts, there, but well, with it, I'm a little concerned about what you're about to do.
All those songs you never sang.
Okay, yeah, no. Again, editor, not singer. I mean, I would like to be a singer, but that's beside the point.
They sit there still, wrapped around your heart, still beating, wrapped so tight. Would you like me to set them free?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm down for a music session. Yeah, I could take a break and do a music session. What we've got lined up? Take on Me? I like Take on Me. I do like a bit of ABBA.
Music maestro, please.
Wait, where'd you get the piano? Oh, God!
Now,
Well, I am Jack, usual host, and joining me this week, the John Lennon to my Paul McCartney.
Oh, very nice, Jack. Thank you.
He probably will have to ask me who was John Lennon. Oh wait, no, that was
Shut up, Jack. You're not bringing up the story again.
If you want that, you can go find the previous episode. But it's published all by Robin Fowle.
Hey, that is me.
I had to throw that jam in. You know I did.
Oh, it gets me every time. Like that's a deep cut, that is, back to when we like first met each other, performed together our very first show. Mm-hmm. Fucking hell.
Question, Robin, we're here, we're talking about The Devil's Court, episode 2 of season 1 of Doctor Who, written by Rusty Davis. Oh, that's a surprise.
Mm.
Directed by Ben Chessel. And can I just say, Robin, I've got a dog, he's called Fred. He is alive, he's not dead. Banger.
I mean, banger. That was absolute banger, yeah. Get that on the top charts, hey?
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I think the most scathing criticism I can say of that song is it sounds like it's one of the ones that Ringo wrote.
Oh, you know what? You say that, and I'm just thinking of the Family Guy joke. It's like, oh, very nice, Ringo. Gonna put it right here on the fridge for all of us to see. Oh my god, I can't do a good accent. Yeah,
Ringo, put it on the fridge here. Yeah. I think mine goes more Birmingham than Liverpool. I do think I can do CS. I think it goes to Birmingham personally, but still, anyway, yeah. Yeah, well, we're talking about Devil's Court here tonight, which is. What an episode! I was like, what can I say about this? And I was like, oh my god, my mind's literally gone blank. It's wow.
Yeah. What? And the thing is, it's a wonderful juxtaposition to Space Babies. Like for those of you who tuned in for my previous one, you know that I was a bit like, you know, this definitely feels at times a little Doctor Who, you know, clear for a younger audience. And then this episode, like the very start, and you're like, oh, okay, yep, tone established. We are in for another wild ride.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I absolutely agree with that. I was saying that with this episode, tone established. My goodness, on so many fronts. So many fronts, but I suppose let's get into the episode itself. We're taking a trip into the past here, Robin, which is obviously, you've spoken before, is your favorite type of episode. You love it when Doctor Who goes back to pre-established events.
I absolutely adore it. I do, just taking the costumes, the themes, and being able to play with things. Those are always my favorites.
Oh, there are some great costumes in this as well. I mean, we really hop and tail around in this episode, because obviously the episode opens in 1925, like the Giggle opens in 1925, which is obvious, you know, a very obvious link that we have the character of Timothy Drake. Which as soon as I heard Timothy Drake, I was like, wait, what is this, a Batman crossover? Because the third Robin is Tim Drake, and I was like, oh wow,
yeah.
And, you know, we have the whole thing there with it being Harbinger or Henry Harbinger next to him. You know, Timothy Drake, being a musical genius, apparently discovers and plays the Devil's Court, which then summons and brings through Jinx Monsoon's character of Maestro.
Absolutely phenomenal performance by them. To take that kind of same sort of energy of Toy Master, but also make it your own character.
Toy Maker.
And to ride that tightrope of, you know, you want to make it like a very fun, over-the-top performance without it becoming pantomime, and still have those very dark undertones of, oh shoot, no, you are a god, you're gonna fuck us over if we mess with you. So
yeah. With this episode, we meet another member of this like elder god trickster like pantheon gods, in that, you know, we're dealing with the maestro here who is, or we're dealing with a maestro here who is very much established as being the Toymaker's child, you know. And they have that great line later on in the episode. It's like, oh, daddy was so bad to me. And it's, again, it is that the Jinx Monsoon, she does an amazing job here of chewing the scenery, but in such a menacing way. I generally think that Maestro is going to go down in history as one of the best one-off guest appearance characters or guest appearance villains in Doctor Who.
100% agree. Like, every scene they were in, like, I was hooked. Like, every time they were on the screen, I was like, oh, I want more of this character. And, oh, just, they knew how to walk the walk, how to talk that talk, and to just, like, and they wore the most fabulous outfits, most beautiful outfits, which, to see that same kind of theme as what their father wore, in which different scenes you have like different fabulous outfits. And actually, I wanted to ask you, as someone who's more familiar with Odor Who, is Harbinger an old character? Just like,
no, Harbinger's brand new with this as well. I often think of Harbinger being, there's a character in DC for Crisis on Infinite Earths called Harbinger.
That's right. Yeah.
So that my always goes there first. But obviously Harbinger is, you know, something about the media and other stories as well. But no, it's Harbinger was for this, and with Maestro, who is created for this as well. And it's really, really cool to see Doctor Who playing with these elder gods and these creatures of unimaginable power. Like, you know, you look at just what the Toymaker did in The Giggle in terms of things. And Maestro does a similarly universe warping, you know, thing here in terms of what they try to do with the music. And they break the fourth wall in this episode like a bunch of times.
They do, yeah. But it definitely feels in keeping with what a god would be able to do. And for them to have that wonderful open introduction to the character, and the moment that they went to the piano, I think all of us were like, come on, do it, play the tune. And when they do it, which also, Star, you are phenomenal for what you've done at the start of this episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you for Jed for helping Star with that as well. Yeah.
But when that tune kicks in, you're immediately like, oh, yep, tone established. We know exactly what's going to be in this. Oh, I'm surprised that this is the second episode. Do you think a stake like this would happen like at the halfway point or something? But no, like already hitting us ass hard.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's so cool as well. Like, everything about Maestro, I think, is so cool. Like, obviously, the whole music motif, you see them in different costumes all the way through, you know. I feel like the one they end in is very much, like, Beatle-inspired. It kind of looks like, you know, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart, like, what the Beatles wear for that, you know. It's, you know, which is very, very cool. And then as well, you have a Multiverse of Madness style musical notes coming to life to
act first as, thing like, I thought of tendrils. yeah
I was like, yeah, Sam Raimi did this better, you know. But no, I loved what they did for it here, and I thought it was so great. And yeah, that moment where they sit down and they play the Doctor Who theme, and it goes into the titles with just the piano, beautiful stuff. We then come to the Doctor and Millie post, and I love it the way it ends as well. The theme ends and it's coming out of the jukebox, so yet again it's kind of breaking the fourth wall again, in that the Doctor Who theme is being played in Doctor Who in a way, you know. And Ruby decides that what she wants to do is she wants to go and see the Beatles record their first album. The Doctor, full of enthusiasm, oh, why have I never done that before? And they go out. And Ruby says, hang on a minute, it's the 60s. Can we not, you know, should we be wearing this? And first of all, I thought that what Ruby was already wearing was actually probably fine for the 60s. But I love that with this new era, they're establishing something different where it's like, oh no, the Doctor's going to change their outfit every episode. Like, because Shooty is too stylish not to be doing that. But also,
oh, 100%.
That scene where they're like getting so giddy and excited to be going getting dressed up, and she's like, and Ruby says, oh, a beehive. And the Doctor's like, oh, babes, I've got loads of wigs.
Yeah.
And like, cuts from them going in the one tunnel and then coming up the top tunnel. And they're all, you know, the Doctor's in that beautiful blue suit, and Ruby's in the, you know, the black and white outfit with the beehive. It's so, it's straight up iconic Doctor Who moments again. Like, I think we'll look back wonderful. At that shot.
Like, they're playing with the scale of the TARDIS, which for new audiences, because they're just getting to grasp the fact that it's bigger on the inside than it is the outside. But when they're also like, oh wait, no, there's extensions to this. It isn't just this dome. There's more to it. And this beautiful, phenomenal set. Like, oh my God, if I could walk around that set. Like, but to have that and, yeah, have those costume changes. Like, when that happened, I very much thought, like, oh, Donna would have had a field day. She would. Like, she was kitted out for her journey. But, like,
yeah.
But Ruby, she doesn't have to worry about that. Clearly, the Doctor has a wardrobe for everyone. So it's like, yeah. Okay.
And again, I just love that line. I've got so many wigs. Like, I think is like the line. It's just like, oh, it's so wonderful. It's so amazing seeing, again, these two schoolgirls, basically best friends, having so much fun traveling through time. And like, they, you know, they do a little dance along Abbey Road, like, you know, on the zebra crossing, like the album cover, Ruby says. Like, And they, you know, they make their way in there. It's interesting to see the Doctor not using the psychic paper to do it, though. It's just...
Yeah, actually. That's very interesting. They just use their natural sort of charisma and just sort of...
They rolled Nat 20 on the charisma, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just Ruby being like, oh, I've worked in retail / like, in front of people before. I know exactly what to say to get this this tea lady on our side. And it's like, as someone who's worked in retail and with people, yeah, 9 times out of 10, just like being confident and just being nice to people does the trick. Yeah.
It's like, as well, and I think like these scenes which follow that, when the Doctor and Ruby are watching first the Beatles and then Cilla Black and then the orchestra, are some of like the funniest scenes of the episode, because you know you already see how excited they are to be number one watching the Beatles in the recording studio, and just the slow change of expression on their faces is so funny as they hear the, you know, I've got a dog, he's called Fred, he is alive,
it's Shooty's expression of just absolute dismay by the end of it, and it's just like, oh.
but Ruby again as well, Millie is selling it so well, because she's like, oh, she's so happy when it starts, and it's just like a slow like to
oh no.
And then I think my absolute favorite bit is when they go in and see Cilla Black, who, by the way, I think was supposed to be in episode more, but like, I think the Beatles were supposed to be in this episode more as well. I think it was cut in different places. And
but
which is going to happen, isn't it? But I think my favorite is the Doctor go like, come on, Cilla, like, he's really rude.
Yeah.
she does her whole rubbish song about, you know, not wanting to be three, and it's just the Shooty going, Oh, Cilla.
Yeah.
I actually had to pause it because I was laughing so much at that point. And then like, again, oh. and then the orchestra playing Free by Mice badly, and just him keeling over and Ruby like
really. Yeah.
It's so great. It's so wonderful.
Oh. It's just little moments like that as well. And like, their chemistry is already great as well, but there's that very quick line as well about they've been traveling, what, 6 months? at this point as well.
Yes, that feels a bit weird, doesn't it?
This is why I thought maybe this was meant to be a later episode, but they were like, no, get it in the second episode because it's that more tense episode to sort of get audiences in, maybe.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because like the doctor says, when did I pick you up from? Like, you know, was it June 2024?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, it's got to be the track. Yeah, it's like, that's a bit weird, isn't it? That we left things on Christmas Eve 2023, and suddenly we're in June, like, and it leaves the question. And it definitely, like, this feels like it should be their, like, second adventure or, like, one of their first adventures together in just in terms of, like, some of the stuff that happened and, like, you know, what Ruby said. But then also, there's also little discrepancies. Like, later on, she's like, Ruby says later on when the doctor is, like, you know, getting her to run from Maestro, she goes, but you never run. And it's like one of the last episodes that he ran away from Cody Man. Like, so yeah, it's weird because it's kind of like a strange conundrum there of it being like, was this going to be episode two? Because like it doesn't quite match up either way. And I think that's going to be one of the nitpicky things that come out of this episode. There are just a few nitpicky things with this episode. Because I, you know, spoilers, I adored it. I thought it was wonderful. There are a few little things that I think that drag it down because of stuff like that. Yeah.
And you know what? Even if this was meant to be episode two intentionally and they were meant to have 6 months, if only there was some sort of platform for them to explore 6 months of not seen on screen content, like some sort of audio drama.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Like, yeah, we have Big Finish, we have books, we have comics. But I think it's a bit weird to be like, here's this, you know, with that big gap. And I've seen other people say it as well. It's weird for it to be the big gap there where we're getting, you know, I think there should always be gaps with this kind of media. But when this is very much, you know, yes, their relationship is established in Ruby Road and Space Babies, but then it should be carrying on to this. And maybe after this episode where you should have gone, okay, here's an expanded media gap, you know, which, so I understand some people's concerns that I also don't see it as a big issue personally myself, but it is something we need to address, definitely.
Yeah, and we've addressed it.
Yeah. So Robin, in the tea room then, following that, the doctor's ordering a cup of tea, getting it for half a crown, who happens to be handing that cup of tea over? It's Susan Twist.
There's always a twist at the end, or, you know, I guess the start in this case.
It's interesting, because she has like a whole thing there again. It's like you said this back when we did Space Babies, that the doctor's got his back to her the entire time, and it's really well directed in that, you know, as he turns, she turns, and it's like, you know, so it's not given away that this is someone that you might have seen before in, you know, I suppose from the doctor's perspective, you probably will only actually maybe have seen her in Space Babies, but you didn't even then. So it's carrying that on through, which is very cool, very interesting. And the doctor and Ruby come to realize that this is a world where music is on its way out, something's happening and things are getting darker, and they have that brilliant scene then in the cafe or the tea room,
cafeteria.
Cafeteria, where the doctor's like, right, you take John Lennon, I'll take Paul. And he goes over a cup of tea, you know, and they are speaking to them, and I think they don't look an awful lot like Paul McCartney and John. Like I think John does a bit, but he's got the glasses like too early. They're going for the iconography that when you think of John Lennon, you think of, you know, with the glasses.
This is the thing, because I watched it with my family, I watched it with my fiance, my parents, and my mum grew up in the 60s. She saw the Beatles live. She did, like on stage. And so I was like, will it pass the test with her? And she's like, nope, I saw them live on stage. I know exactly how they look. But it was interesting because they even mentioned, both of them, how a lot of the fashions in this episode were actually too soon. Like some of them were like 5 years too early from their own personal experiences. And again, you know, it's going to be like whoever's doing set designs and like the history of things. But sometimes you do take liberties. You do go, well, this is what people think of the 60s. Just like when you think of the 80s, Stranger Things certainly glamours things up to make it be like, oh, that's clearly the 80s. I think that's understandable, but bless these actors, like they can do the acting.
They do a fantastic job though. Like I think particularly the actor playing John Lennon and Paul as well, actually is very good as well. They're both
this is why they were chosen.
It is a shame we didn't get to see more of George and Ringo, who in my opinion looks more like Howard Wolowitz from the Big Bang Theory. But
I just keep thinking, like, if this happened to the chip that we were and we had the fam, it's just like, do they end up having an argument of which one of them takes Wingo? And it's just like,
oh, and it would be no, Ryan would have to take Ringo. Yeah. Oh, I bought the bloody school store, I got to take Ringo. But then it's a really poignant scene actually there, where they're talking about music and about how in their chords you have a song that you know, just, and like it's really beautiful and it speaks to the power of music and that so as well. And I think, you know, they're talking about, you know, this is the last hurrah. John says, like, I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna sit down and get a real job. And then he says, but then why do I wake up every day crying? And it's and it feels very much like, you remember in series 3 where in Vincent the Doctor, the Vincent says, you know, you're crying, Amy. She doesn't realize why, because Rory's gone and she doesn't remember. It's very much like that. It's like they're recognizing they have this loss. They're missing the music, which people need. People need music in their soul, but they can't figure out why they feel like that.
There's a lot of really nice slower scenes in this episode. It never feels like it's too dragged in some places, but there's that really nice moment there. There's a really nice moment later on, which I'm sure we're going to get to. We know the scene, but it's just those moments that really sort of go, no, this is why music is at stake in this episode. Yes, there's this whole conundrum of this alternative timeline where the world's gone to hell, but to have it be over something that's so intuitive to us as a people, how music, especially the 60s as well, like, not only is it great because it's the Beatles, but it's the swinging 60s. It's that music. It's how music was revolutionary in that time, and how, especially that period, how important it was. Like, to have all those layers to this episode that really add to it. And again, like, adds to Ruby being a bit of a musician herself, you know, it's all these lovely little connections which really make it like a just really sweet moment.
Yeah, I love how it's really important to the plot that Ruby is a musician herself. Like, you know, she's not that good. And the doctor's like, no, I saw you. You know, December 23rd. I think in the actual episode, it's actually the 22nd he actually sees her at that point, because the 23rd is when they're in the club. But, you know, that doesn't matter. That's just
it doesn't matter.
You know, it's just a, you know, it is just a small issue, you know, that bit there. But then I really love the scene, which is slower later on, is when is right after that, where the doctor's got the piano brought up to the roof of their, you know, and he says to Ruby, like, you know, oh, there's no love songs in the world. Can you imagine that, Ruby? She's like, I've got no love songs. And they come out onto this rooftop and the doctor's looking over because they can see the smog all around. Oh boy, Robin. Oh boy. He mentions, like, oh, I live over there right now in Shoreditch in a little place called Totter's Lane with my granddaughter Susan. And I instantly went, oh fuck. because I love that they're addressing it, but then also made me think, oh God, are they going to do something with Susan later on? Because is he bringing it up now, like, so candidly, unless later in this series we're going to see something Susan-related?
Well, isn't it confirmed that her actress is coming back? I swear.
No. Not Karen Ford isn't confirmed. No, it's... You know, that rumor does the run every series, just like the Ronnie.
Okay. So it is just a rumor, because I thought I heard from somewhere that she was coming back, and that's why I thought, this
ha,
makes
ha,
sense.
Ha ha ha! Eat shit. No.
Okay. but I did think that was a really nice moment to address that, as well as to actually have, I guess, a little bit of exposition, but to sort of explain to audiences that, hey, actually, I've been around for this long. I've had other faces. I've had a granddaughter, of all things. And that's big news for a lot of people.
It's big news for Ruby as well, isn't it? Like, she's like,
oh, huge. What?
Like, it worries my little brain that's like, oh, does everything have to be, you know, something pre thing? But then it could just be a cute little thing that's like, I'm literally like, you know, just over there right now. And it could just be, again, playing on the iconography and being like, oh, here's a little, you know, thing here. Obviously, that scene comes to Ruby playing her own theme, which has been written after her mum's breakup with her girlfriend, and she's written this song to help with that there, and it's this beautiful theme, which, you know, Meister says later on, it's a song for lovesick lesbians, which is such a beautiful line. I think it's the first time lesbians ever been mentioned in. Ever said in Doctor Who, which is fantastic, you know, from there as well. And I think it's a really beautiful scene of the Doctor looking out, and they're trying to bring, you know, Maestro, whatever creatures, they're trying to summon it to them, basically, aren't they, by playing music. And it's a beautiful theme. I do think that the actual theme, I think that scene where she's playing the piano probably just goes on a little bit too long in terms of the episode.
I think it's a beautiful scene. I think it's really important to the episode, especially as it's that beautiful scene, which is suddenly boom, stopped by the arrival of the villain. And it's like, oh, damn. Okay. But I would admit, like, when I watched it, I loved it. I thought it was really beautiful. And there's kind of a moment where it feels like, oh, that was really nice. Okay. It feels like it's dying down. We're still going.
Yeah.
I actually looked at the clock at one point thinking, okay, we've had the reactions of people, and it's a really beautiful scene, but, you know, there's such a thing as
it really got me the bit where the woman, like, sort of starts crying. She's like proper like
tearing. Yeah.
Like, it's really like, you know, you can see it touching their hearts, like it's what they've been missing, you know. And then obviously Maestro bursts out the piano with the which is the
such
a great little callback, you know, and it literally hits the Doctor like, oh my god, that's the giggle. Like,
because I wasn't sure if they were going to address that or not, because I had to turn to my parents and be like, oh, that's the giggle, and they're like, was it? It's like, yeah, and I was just really frantic at that moment, because I was like, yeah, I got that connection.
Well, that's the thing. My wife heard it, Jodie heard it, and she went, wait, that's the same laugh. Mm. Like, it's like before we even got to anything about like the Maestro's relationship to the toy maker, and I was just like, I love you so much. I love you so much right now. But yeah, no, and it's that whole scene then when Maestro, you know, Jinx Monsoon comes down on the same crane wire down from the roof, and the Doctor and Ruby are hiding underneath, and
Oh my god,
Jinx's performance, and just chewing the scenery. She's like, I heard music. I can't do it justice, you know, but it's beautiful stuff. And I really love the whole moment there as well, where the Doctor used the sonic to cancel out the noise in the entire sounding area. And that whole scene then when Maestro is like trying to talk and realizing what's happening, and then you know, Maestro does a little golf clap, and you know, and then with the, you know, because Maestro has that little tuning fork all the way along as well, and using that to bring back the sound into the area, it's just, oh, it's so, again, Jinx Monsoon, my god, she just gave the absolute performance of a lifetime. I really think we're going to come back and look at Maestro as a one-off villain in the show with real reverence, like, going forward. I really think she's going to go down in history.
They were just absolutely incredible in that scene. And it's really interesting as well, because it follows right after a very kind of quiet scene of playing the piano to a very quiet scene, because it's tense and it's like, this is their lives. It's like seeing the Doctor again, a second episode where he is scared, which is very interesting for this Doctor to not always be super brave and to actually use the sonic screwdriver again in a new way, which I'm loving the way that we're getting all these different new effects for it. I keep thinking, like, I always think, like, could we ever get a return to, like, Lego Dimensions, you know, or have a Lego Doctor Who game and he just constantly gets new abilities? And that's what I always think.
It made me think of Star Beast, when the Doctor was using, the 14th Doctor was using first of all, creating the little, like, screens of the Sonic, and then creating the shield. I was like, oh, this is another cool thing that the Sonic can do. And I think it's really, really cool. And it is really interesting, because it's the Doctor's then, like, you know, I can't use that on them again. Like, it's not,
yes,
you know, and that, again, later on, you know, the Maestro is like, like, goes, and does a, like, you know, an operatic note, which then causes the song to sort short freeze, and she's, and they're like, can't trick me twice, honey. Like,
also, yeah, it's
so good.
It is. And, you know, we have to also go back a little bit, because the poor little old lady who gets sadly taken out, I didn't know this until after watching this, but she actually had a bit of history with Doctor Who, didn't she, Jack?
She does, yes, thank you. Yes, absolutely. She was actually the fourth Doctor, like, costume designer. As I need to double check what her name is right now. I'm completely honest.
Oh, I should have done my homework.
It's June, I believe. June, fourth Doctor costume designer.
Because she's great in that. Like, it's a non-speaking role, but, like, she's great with her. Her facial expressions, everything. What was her name, sorry?
June Hudson. June Hudson.
Oh, who is, yeah, wonderful.
So it's beautiful seeing her come back into, you know, in this way, and being like, oh, here's a, you know, here's something to celebrate you and Doctor. You get to be killed by a baddie. You know?
Oh, it's just what I've always wanted.
Yeah, but it's a great scene. You know, she's there playing the piano, and Maestro comes out and just like, ah, and grabs her. It's so cool. And then big nitpick, Robin. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Following that scene, the Doctor says about how the last time he faced a creature from the Pantheon or a god like this, his soul was split in two, and the bi-generation is now being treated as like a source of trauma for the 15th Doctor.
Okay.
That feels weird. That feels weird, because the whole thing of it in the giggle was that it's like a new fancy thing. Like, you know, the 14th Doctor's regeneration isn't being treated as a character death, it's he gets to carry on, the 15th Doctor comes out of it, but apparently it's their soul being split in two, and it's, you know, that it's a traumatic thing now, and it's, you know, I know other people have gone into how 15 is too emotional, because, you know, the 15 should be more together now, because 14th Doctor has gone and done that therapy, and 15 is better because of that. But no. Even if someone's gone to therapy or gone to, and, you know, tried to improve themselves and tried to be better, they're still going to have triggers. They're still going to have things which make them feel, you know, like that. But it just felt weird that the bi-generation itself was being used, like, again, like a traumatic event, you know?
See, I understand completely where you're coming from. I actually saw it in a different light when they mentioned that. I thought when they mentioned that, it wasn't so much them meaning it as a traumatic event, but kind of explaining, like, what's kind of making this new personality for this character? Because Shutigatwo has been coming out, which I think is kind of a perfect example of like almost, well, they are a newborn doctor, but it feels very newborn. Like they're very excited by things. They're very happy and excited, but they're also, they've shown a lot of vulnerability in just these two episodes, especially. Like they're clearly capable, but to have a doctor who's not always going to be the joker Rowan Atkinson always did, or I'll tell you later, it's not always going to be that. It's going to be like, they're going to have those moments they face where there's uncertainty. And that's what I took from it, as the soul being split into being more like them, sort of literally just being split into this new personality.
Maybe.
And
Yeah, I suppose.
That's what I took from it.
I suppose we can only wait and see, can't we? In terms
Yeah.
of, it might be that it's expanded upon more, but I found that a bit strange there. And I did like how we got to the moment we always get with a companion when they travel to the past for the first time, where the companion says, "Well, the world can't end in such and such because I'm from the future, and that doesn't happen." And the doctor go in. I love the idea that, rather than being the doctor being like, time can be rewritten, and like, the doctor just goes this time. All right, I'm gonna fucking show you.
Yeah, because it's like Rose asks that question back in, oh, The Unquiet Dead, I think, is when she first brings it up. And then to actually, for the first time, be shown why you can't just travel somewhere else. Time is moving, time is flowing. And I
Slimy,
think that
whimy.
this is, oh, yeah, it's quite right, quite right. But to get to see destroyed London and really take in, oh, this is why they don't just run away in the TARDIS. They've got to stay and solve the problem. And
Exactly, yeah.
it's harrowing. And to
It is.
see,
It's so
oh,
harrowing, and especially again in our current world, to see a version of London looks like that. It's truly scary, and then they're about to leave in the TARDIS, and we see the beautiful stiletto come down,
oh,
and
yeah.
maestro, boom, it's their realm. It's like the toy maker's realm, but they can expand it out like that. And it's so that whole scene there where maestro's at the piano and playing it here and there, and says, you're like the time, the Lord Temporal who bound my father and surrounded him in salt. And the doctor, like, oh, so you're the child of the toy maker, and it all comes out there, and then daddy was so bad, daddy was so tough, daddy, and then all the great stuff. And the maestro not necessarily recognizing the doctor is this, but like not really being like, oh, you're the doctor, you're a threat, just being like, oh, you're a plaything, this is kind of cool, I can do you, and like you're timey-wimey, and then go does the little bit of the theme on the piano again, oh my God. And when we realize what Maestro's plan is to wipe out all life and just a nuclear winter, the greatest music of all, and I can go to the spheres and take the music from there, and then it's like, what, with no one to play music, and they go, I'm going solo. What a line! What a fantastic line! Oh my God.
It's wonderful because it's in keeping with the character and in keeping with the themes of music and the like, which,
Yeah,
and I love the whole time.
so many musical puns, so many musical puns in that. And
Like,
my big thing going into this was I was going to try and be like, you're harping on a bit there, Robin. I was going to try and be like, there's a bit of fiddling going on, or it's like, maybe we got to a sad bit. It's like, oh, I'm playing the world's smallest violin. But that was I didn't do that running joke because I'm not that clever, but still.
but I love as well to toy with the doctor. Like, not only have they brought them to the realm, but they're playing the piano. They're just the line on the piano, sort of just spreading themselves all out. And it's just like,
There's a great bit where Jinx, she like swivels forward, and it kind of like is like the sliver of a snake, and it's so, oh, it's so beautifully shot. It really is.
It's again just this character where you know they're intimidating and they know it. They can just lounge about. They don't care. Like, what's the doctor going to do in this impossible situation?
They are all powerful. Like, they are all powerful. Like, yeah, what can the doctor do in this situation other than potentially beat them in a contest, you know?
Yeah.
The doctor has this thing, you know, where he goes like, you know, no, your father established the rules of play and I have a right to know. Like, you know, basically this is going to, we're going to have to end this at a contest of some kind, aren't we? Mm. You know, and then they go back because the maestro is fiddling with the TARDIS and the doctor manages to fast return back to the 60s to sort things out. Goes in, picks up John Lennon's guitar, and obviously Ruby is taken by Maestro then, and Maestro is going to try and take the music from Ruby, but realizes there's something about her. There's, you know, it's, again, it's a beautiful scene where they're in the big orchestra hall. Ruby is being suspended by the notes there. Maestro's in a new costume again, looking amazing. And Maestro's like, sing, you know, like, you know, and Ruby starts singing this song. And then Maestro's like, no, there's something wrong here. This is something, there's something about the oldest one of all. And we're getting finale, yeah, aren't we? We're getting like, oh, okay, this is them. So it's really interesting to be like, okay, maybe there's something extra about Ruby's parentage that we don't know. Maybe Ruby's going to be some sort of another offshoot of this pantheon, but in human form. Who knows? You know, that's a theory. It could be. It could just be that, you know, Ruby's parent is like the toy maker or like, you know, Maestro as well. Mm. And again, it was chilling how Maestro was like, there's a hidden song in her. And we start hearing the...
Yeah.
Which is being sung. And, like, and the snow comes as well. That's so it was just cool. It was such a beautiful visual, you know. And Maestro seems genuinely, like, afraid of... just what Ruby is there, which is really interesting again.
And when Maestro's afraid, you know that they're clearly building up to like the end game, you know. Ooh, the and it's great as well because we very much get following on from that Doctor Strange battle of the music type thing, and it's a great one.
Yes. I'm sorry, the second Maestro said music battle, my head went, this is Scott Pilgrim versus the world, and it's going to pop through.
Yeah.
Music battle. The Doctor and Ruby versus Maestro.
I'm shocked no one's done that edit yet, and I want to see that happen.
But
the thing is, of course, she's playing the fiddle, like the proper, like the devil playing the fiddle or violin.
Oh my God, of course, yes. And the whole thing about it is they're battling to send... The Doctor literally says, you know, I just have to play the right notes to send you back to hell. And it is very much, they're playing the fiddle like they're Lucifer, like the devil. Oh my God, Robin. Well done, Robin. Well done. That's the right
trick. I get some things right. But it's great because when it's the Doctor and Ruby working together, they're all... playing the notes and everything, and like
they turn around behind them.
It's like, look, I know you're both good at music, but it's kind of your life's on the line. You don't have to show off that much, you know. But
great, yeah. And obviously, then, you know, they win that part. The fiddle breaks apart, and the Doctor's like, I just have to play the right notes now, and he's playing so many of them, and then bomb note, and the Doctor and Ruby are gonna die. Like, Maestro's gonna have their fun with them. They literally knock the piano out of the studio, and it's only because John Lennon and Paul McCartney walk by that they manage to beat Maestro and find the hidden chord. Like, the Doctor and Ruby were gonna lose. They were going to die, you know. Like, that, you know, Ruby literally is like, I can't breathe. There's that really shocking bit where the Doctor's trying to force his way out of the drum.
Oh, yeah.
It's freaky as hell.
Yeah, that's the moment that they showed off in the trailer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you're like, what is that? And again, we could potentially get that turn left episode if it was Wingo that came across the piano, but again, sorry, that's just me being really mean. It's just like Paul like shows up, is about to play the notes, and then Wingo just pushes him aside, like, oh no, let me have a crack at this.
It's like, oh, Wingo, poor Ringo. Poor Ringo. Ringo's just going, peace and love, peace and love. Oh, God almighty. Yeah, no. And then, so yeah, and it's really cool because, you can see in that moment, Maestro, Jinx, Monsoon, she is having the time of her life in that part, the way she's banging the drum and laughing and singing and all the operatic flashes. And then finally the note is played and they're trying to run away, but the piano pulls them back in and we get, again, finale baiting, the Maestro's head pop just there beneath, as they're trying to stop themselves being pulled down the piano. The one who waits is almost here. And it's like, oh, really? Already? Oh my God. Because, the one who waits is mentioned in the giggle. The toy maker talks about, how, number one, he fought the master and played, the gods of Ragnarok or what have you. And, but, the one he wouldn't face is the one who waits. And it's like, who, what? And then when they move on, this is, that big thing now. I think this is going to be our end villain of the series,
Oh, definitely, for sure. But the fact that we still don't know much about them, which is great. I don't want to know, whether or not this is tying into Twist or whether this is going to be a wholly different character. Like, that is really, really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And
so, yeah. And it's interesting as well, because, history is put right at that point, and I think it's really cool, and they're up on the roof. Okay. Speaking of Twist, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
What are your feelings on the big musical number, that being, there's always a twist, there's always a twist, there's always a twist at the end?
So I'm of two minds about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So okay, I think, me too. I think, first of all, I think the fact that it ends in a very, it's Footloose. That's exactly what it is. And I think the fact that music has been such an important component of the entire episode. Yeah, it's not just, it's not just they chose the 60s and the Beatles. No, it's the fact that it's integral to the plot. It's what they're trying to save. It's the connection of music to Ruby and to her mother and all these different connections. So we know music is key, and it does feel fitting that there would be some kind of musical or dance number at the end. Whether or not it would be to that kind of fourth wall breaking is another thing, whether it should have just have ended on just them dancing. And the other thing is, whether or not the song was written by Russell T. Davis, because, man can write a story, but whether or not he wrote the song...
Oh, I mean, it would have been Murray Gold that did the song. It would have been Murray, the composer, who would have done that. And Murray even has like a little cameo in that scene as well. It's like, the guy playing the piano as it's going.
Of course.
Yeah, the issue I have, and obviously we have Shirley and Johannes, who people will know from, my mum knows them from Strictly Come Dancing. She absolutely loves Johannes, or Jojo, as she calls him. She absolutely loves him. Literally went to see him in Cardiff doing a show, House of Jojo, like the week before this aired. So, so she absolutely loved seeing Johannes show up there. I think the scene is great, and I think you can explain it away by being like, oh, this is the remnants of Maestro's power sort of dissipating, a bit like how in the giggle you had, the mallet coming out and bamming the TARDIS so that two appear, a bit like how that's a similar thing. I don't know that the scene really felt earned or warranted in the way they set it up. And again, this could be nitpicky, but I think the Doctor's going like, Ruby, one thing you have to understand, in all my adventures in time and space, there's always a twist at the end. And I like the wink to camera. I like the fourth wall break there. We've seen that in trailers, looking at the camera and the wink, fourth wall break. I don't know in the actual episode of that. And it just feels so there isn't always a twist at the end, mate. Like,
no,
not always, really, you know. So it's, you know, yeah, a bit strenuous, like... a link. And I felt like maybe, you know, in the end where they're at, you know, they're on the Abbey Road zebra crossing again.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
they do like the big, you know, big.
They do big,
but on that, you know, it's like, you know, it's the piano notes, which is cool. And then they close the cars there, bom, 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 you know, and the doors.
Yeah.
I don't know if maybe it should have just ended with that instead. And I say that really, really loving the LSD trip that is, you know, there's always a twist.
The thing is, Doctor Who, you can have fun with it. For crying out loud, it's a show about a blue police box that travels through time with, like, not all, but, you know, sometimes bug-eyed monsters and the like. You know, there is an element of silliness to it. Like, yeah. While not necessarily all the stuff from the previous episode was my cup of tea, I still enjoyed it immensely. And I know that a lot of other people did. I think with this, I think the idea of a Footloose type ending was definitely the kind of the payoff to a musical kind of episode. I mean, this isn't like a huge CW musical episode from The Flash or something like they did,
and
I
kind of wish that's what we had. I kind of wish that, you know, really, if we're going to go for it, and, you know, I wish we had. And I'll be honest, I don't feel that There's Always a Twist is that much of a bop. Like, it's just the kind of,
I wasn't a fan of it. Like, you get the initial thing, and then it just keeps repeating the words, and it's like, and this is why I was like,
For me, it goes Goblin Song.
Oh, yeah.
Then it goes My Dog Fred.
Yeah, I was going to say My Dog Fred beats It's Always a Twist, like, and that's kind of sad.
it's weird that, isn't it? It's like, you know, Murray Gold in Unleashed talks about how, you know, it'd be really difficult to try and do a Beatles song, you know, a lost Beatles song, but a bad Beatles song, I can do that. But then it kind of slaps. It kind of, like, I have a dog, he's... Like, it's been in my head since I watched the episode, and I've watched the episode 3 times, and I felt yet again my enjoyment was more and more each time. So, yeah. And I did like it, you know.
I feel like having something... I mean, sometimes you want to have like a bit of a sour end to an episode to match the themes. Sometimes you want a more of a joyous end. And maybe if they had just done a little, let's all have a party because everyone's singing and dancing, and maybe they come away from the party, and that's when they do the kind of the big moment on the zebra crossing. That could be really nice.
Yeah.
Like, and the musical number itself, like, they're all clearly having a time of their life.
Yeah.
Like, you can see that from
so well. It's so well choreographed, I have to say. Like, in terms of, like, it's so brilliant in terms of that. And I think that, you know, the little cameos in it as well are really great. I just.
Again, and of course,
isn't it? Yeah,
and yeah, it shows off that they can clearly dance, and clearly shows off that Shooty with his twisting of the hips has got a butt, which my fiance pointed out again. I was like, all right, you strike two.
I suppose what I'd say is that as much as I've enjoyed these and Church on Ruby Road, is that. And I love Church on Ruby Road. It's probably the episode. It's probably one of the episodes I've seen most because my daughter loves it so much and is always asking for the Goblin one. And then Ruby Sunday. What wrong with Ruby Sunday? The Goblin one is what she says. Bless her. She loves. She's only three, and she loves Ruby. She absolutely adores Ruby. It's so sweet and so lovely to see. But I think I'm still waiting for that. But wow. Okay, here we go. This is. Like, this is a all-time classic. This is a GOAT story. And you never know. We might just get it next week. We've got Boom by Stephen Moffat next week. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I know that Boom, obviously Stephen Moffat, I'm very excited about that. I know that you're especially excited for the episode that following that.
Yeah.
Which that's going to be interesting because we're going to be at MCM then, which, hey, those of you listening who are going to MCM London, maybe check out our panel. You know, we've got some fabulous guests on board, and afterwards we're, well, not you, the audience, I'm afraid. It's a closed off watch party, but we're going to be watching the episode that night.
Yeah, we will be.
So,
Yeah, that is part of the Doctor Who Community show, and Robin is joining myself as host, as a guest, which is going to be wonderful, you know, with some amazing people as well. I tell you what, Robin, let's wrap up our thoughts on the episode by let's get to
Yes.
the rating part, okay? Because I think we said a lot, and I think we said our grievances. We said what we'd loved as well. We've praised it a lot because I think it is. I really think it is a wonderful episode. I just have those
Same.
little, you know, nitpicks. I think I'm going to give it something, and I
It's
think
difficult.
it's difficult because I've seen a lot of people online that loved Space Babies hate Devil's Court, and I've seen the reverse as well. Myself, I enjoyed both. I would say I enjoyed Space Babies that little bit more, but I feel that Devil's Court is a better episode. If you know what I mean, I just it's more about my
Yeah.
enjoyment than that. So I feel like I can only probably say about like give it like an 8, like I did Space Babies. I go 8 again, you
Eight
know.
is a great score, it is. Like, it's really interesting you bring that up actually, because with my family, it was very much my fiance, my father, they definitely enjoyed Space Babies more, but then me and my mum really enjoyed The Devil's Chord more. And like we all had fun with both episodes and just having that experience. I'd certainly say that I enjoyed Devil's Chord a lot more than Space Babies. This was very much, again, it helps that it's my jam and butter. It's like it's the 60s, you know, it's a past
Yeah,
episode.
you're
And
you love your past episodes, your past whore you.
oh yeah, I am. I've been very much debating, like, oh, is this a 7.5? Is it an 8? And you know, I think I'm going to settle on an 8, after our sort of discussions, because at the end of the day, even though we have our nitpicks, we still come at the end of it like
Yeah.
really enjoying it. Like, and we've still got like six more episodes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And literally just today it's been announced that the Christmas episode this year will be written by Stephen Moffat and it's called Joy to the World.
It's such a good title. And
Yeah.
oh,
And you know
yeah.
what? It's the first time in Revival history that the showrunner has not been writing the Christmas episode. So it's very interesting that Moffat's doing that. So yeah, that's some hot tea for you right there. Robin, we've said our thoughts. It's nice that we've I think you know both agreeing on 8 is great that I can say my friend or my best friend or
Okay,
you were not
Jim.
expecting a Jujutsu Kaisen reference in this podcast, were you?
No,
No.
I don't know why I knew what you were going for, but I just thought that was like suddenly your Liverpool accent had just gotten that much worse, and it was like some obscure Beatles reference.
Absolutely not. Come on. Let's see what our faithful listeners said over to the space-time telegraph. Just like we like to do on the podcast, we love to get your thoughts and feelings on the episode here. We haven't got that many this week, but we have got a couple. First comes from friend of the show, our co-host on Dimension Daleks, if we ever get that done, from Davis, the broke cannon man himself. Sam says, ah, really loud. Volume on too loud. 5 out of 10. So, ooh, okay.
Oof, wow. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. I know
Yeah.
Sam is a strange beast, and honestly, I want to sit. I with every episode of Doctor Who, I like to sit down and hear his take on it because it's, you know, quite interesting, you know.
It's always interesting to hear different thoughts, and I'd love to hear a more elaborate one on that. But yeah,
absolutely, yeah. Next one comes from another friend of the show, the Vacuum of Comments at Vacuum of Comments. Good old Ben. He may have bad Cybermen takes, but let's see what he says here about the episode. He says, it reminds me of Idiot's Lantern because it's a historical where the event / historical celebrity is kept at a distance. That's true.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
It is true, actually, because you think about, you know, the event is the coronation in Idiot's Lantern, isn't it? And with this, the Beatles and Cilla Black and all that are kind of kept, they're bit players, whereas it's Maestro's episode, isn't it? Yeah, which is interesting. Ben also says, I can't decide how new it actually is. Under the Hood, it doesn't have a single beat that isn't from Pyramid of Mars, which it brings to the table. What it brings to the table is being the most. So that's, you've not seen Pyramids of Mars, so I'm going to leave that there just in case that ends up being something. But that's, do you know what? Pyramids of Mars would be a great one for us to cover on our Classic Who reviews. I think that's one you'd really enjoy. Maybe that's the one we sit down with next. You know, once we've done this series with shooting, maybe the next Classic Who one we do is Pyramids of Mars. I think you'd enjoy that one.
Okay, that sounds like a good one to me, mate.
Yeah, it's like The Mummy meets Doctor Who. So
what, like Brendan Fraser Mummy?
Yeah, but less the cast is going to make you bicurious.
Oh, I don't know if that's maybe not what to watch it now.
next up and lastly, we have an email. If you ever want to email the podcast with your thoughts or theories or anything else, please just send that to anawfullotofrunningpodcast@gmail.com. This comes from Zach Rosenfield. Zach says, it pains me to say this, but I really didn't like this one. Maestro is a character I found really obnoxious and irritating. And every time they were on screen, I just wanted them to shut up. Plus, that twist at the end was embarrassing to watch. It just really brought me out of the episode. Just really brought the episode down tremendously for me. I do have positives, though. Shooty and Millie are still great as usual. They have wonderful chemistry together, and I especially love their reactions to my dog, as well as the scene where the Doctor shows Ruby a potential catastrophic future where Maestro wins. Very reminiscent of a similar scene from Pyramids of Mars. Yet again, Pyramids of Mars being referenced here. You know, maybe there'll be more Pyramids of Mars references in this series as well. Who knows in terms of the final villain? But I think there's some valid stuff there, which Zach says, you know, in terms of, you know, end of the day, that's the twist at the end scene is going to be very divisive for a lot of people because it's so different to a lot of people's sort of perception of what Doctor Who is. I loved it.
I mean, we both gave the episode a pretty high score, but even we were both a bit like of two sides to it. So, and I think it's okay to feel that way. But I think those are some really good points. It has just been very interesting these two episodes because everyone online has very different opinions and. I think the fact, though, that for the most part, at least from what I've seen, is people being, for the most part, civil and being, like, actually giving it a really high score and saying that they're still excited for the series and still enjoying what they're getting. I think the fact that there's those people voicing those opinions over all the crap who, let's face it, non-fans, you know, people who are just like just wanting to shit on it for the sake of shitting on it, which is like, do you guys not have anything better to do, you know? Just,
well, they don't
no. Oh, but you know, that's why we're here, getting all of your fabulous like your little responses to the episode and talking about them ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And it's why we're here to talk about Doctor Who, because we're passionate about it and we love Doctor Who. So, yeah. Speaking of things we love, Robin, I'm going to take you over to your lovely little dessert course now. It's time for a Cannon Buster.
Yay!
Okay, so, Robin.
Mm.
that we, you know, in this episode, we have another member of the pantheon of sort of gods or elder gods or weird sort of trickster gods appearing in this. You know, we've met the toy maker so far. In this, we meet Maestro. There's actually another pantheon of gods, which is canon and real in Doctor Who.
Oh, do tell.
Robin, the Greek gods are real in Doctor Who. So where is it in something like The Girl Who Waited revealed that Odin is not so much real? And like, you know, but the Doctor and River mentioned going to Asgard at one point, and I think the Doctor is revealed to be Loki as well at some point as well. Weird stuff there. Yeah, no, the Greek gods are real. The Greek gods are real, Robin, in Doctor Who.
Oh, no. I just had a sudden thought of Ruby's father is now Zeus. And he like,
oh,
So people
that do not know, Zeus in Greek mythology is not like Zeus, good father, loving husband in the Disney Hercules. He's a serial R word, is what he is. You know, trigger warning for people like that. He's. Yeah, so that's not great. But here's the real fact that I wanted to give you, Robin. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you love Brigadier Left Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart? Don't you love the Brigadier?
Yeah, Brigadier's great. You know, amazing at punching masters in the face.
Yeah. Did you know that in the aftermath of the Second World War, so before he even met the Doctor, before his life went batshit crazy and insane.
Okay.
Before that, in the aftermath of the Second World War, the Brigadier, as at that time, Second Lieutenant Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart, was sent to Albania, where he met the Immortals, who are the Greek gods, and fell in love with Persephone. Okay, wait, I'm not done, Robin. That's not the entire fact. See, he fell in love with Persephone.
Okay.
When she was kidnapped by Hades, he went with Hermes to the underworld to rescue her.
You would think that someone's gone through that experience would kind of change their perception on meeting the Doctor and be a bit more open to the fact of this new stranger appearing. Like,
yeah.
Where the hell does this come from? Is this Big Finish? A comic?
No, it's a novel. Of course, it is a novel. But yeah, no. Basically, what I'm telling you, Robin, is that the hit musical Hadestown is based on the Brigadier.
You couldn't even finish that. You couldn't even finish that.
Yeah, literally. Obviously, it's the Greek myth, isn't it? That of Persephone and, you know, I can't remember the Greek hero in it, but you know, the whole idea is that he's supposed to, you know, Hades is like, okay, you can have your wife back, but you've got to walk every step up of the, you know, out from the underworld and back onto Earth, but you can't look back. You can't look back.
Yes, if
you
do, that's the story.
That's what it is here, but isn't it just weird to think of the Brigadier, like, again, pre-meeting the Doctor, chilling out with all these immortals, falling in love with Persephone, being like, Hermes, we need to go down to the underworld and shoot Hades in the face. 5 rounds rapid. What? It's just weird stuff, isn't it?
That's beautiful. And I now want the Brigadier in like the Hades video game as well. Just fucking hell, that'd be amazing. Oh,
I mean, there's already a Doctor Who connection in that I've isn't the character you play in Hades called Zagreus or
yeah.
So there you go. Zagreus sits inside your head. Zagreus sees you when you're sleeping. All that stuff, you know. So yeah, on that bombshell, Robin. I think that's quite a good time for us to segue and say, join us next time for another bombshell, that being Stephen Moffat's return to Doctor Who. Boom. As we review it next week. I have been Jack.
I have been Robin.
This has been an awful lot of running. Thanks for listening and keep running.
Did you really think that was it? Did you really think I was gone? No. Come on. Every listener by now, you should all know there's always a twist at the end. And in this case, this twist is where I'm placing my little Stars Corner segment that Jack has kindly let me have. Which is basically where I quickly talk about the episode. I was going to place it earlier, but then the twist at the end joke was delicious, delightful, too fun. So I'll do this quickly because I took up a lot of time at the start. Overall thoughts, fun, campy, enjoyable. It kind of had the energy of Doctor Who and the Pirates mixed with that kind of late 2000s Doctor Who that obviously kind of RTD is recycling, which can be a good thing, can be a bad thing. I'm not sure where I sit on that yet. I would like to see a lot more new ideas, but I'm not opposed to some of the repetitive stuff they've done. I really enjoyed the overall episode. I really enjoyed Maestro. I thought the music was good, the acting was good. There was a few iffy points which have been mentioned, especially the 6-month gap. I wasn't too keen on that. And while admittedly I think it's probably one of my favourite moments, I do get what people are saying about the whole, oh, why are you referencing Susan very, very specifically? Personally, I don't think it's actually leading to anything. I think it's just a fun little reference because they're in London, 1963, and you don't want to, miss out such a fun little reference. Also, I know that at the time this was written, the whole thing with an unearthly child hadn't happened, but I do kind of see it as a bit of a fuck you to a certain someone. But yeah, no, significant points that I really, really did like. I'm very pro twist at the end. I think it was fun. I think it was goofy, and I like that. Honestly, one of the big things about this episode is it's kind of what I would like to have for a Star Doctor episode. But also, I would probably have it longer, because this does feel, and so did Space Babies, and I'm recording this before I record my thoughts on Space Babies, but as Jack mentioned, there's like little bits sort of missing, and it's kind of like, it flows alright, but it feels like you're missing context here and there, and I hope that kind of smooths out later. It's a little noticeable, but overall, as I said, pretty much loved it. Great. I'm pretty easy to appease when it comes to Doctor Who. And in terms of ranking, I'm going to give it a 9.5, I think. I did really, really enjoy it. I thought it was really stupid. It would be a 10, but there's the little iffy things which I'm kind of like, and also not too keen on John Lennon saving the day, considering certain things, but I'm not going to get into that. 9.5, thought it was great. Now, what were they saying? How do they end the episode again? Keep running.
Thank you for listening to An Author Running, a Doctor Who podcast. This episode was edited by Star, herself, our editor-in-chief, as you will. The theme was provided by Hudson Media. Please go and check them out on YouTube and Twitter. And if you want to support the show, please consider donating to our Ko-fi. There is absolutely zero obligation, but it does help keep the lights on. Thank you so much. If you want to follow myself, Jack, Robin, or even Star over on Twitter, please go ahead and do so. We're very easy to find. Thanks very much. Ta-ra for now. Keep running.